Tisha B'Av presents me with the following dilemma. The dilemma is pretty simple. On the one hand, we're not allowed to study Torah except for the negative aspects of Torah study. And so therefore, what we've been doing all day in different ways, shapes, and forms is to really get a handle on those sections of Torah that one is allowed to study in order to build on the day and to be able to get a sense of the day. And on the other hand, while one is not allowed to study Torah, how could you one live a life without Torah at all? And for my own self, in order to make some sort of shalom, some sort of peace, so for the last couple of years, we have developed what I call the Profiles in Exile series, where we've taken one of the greats of Jewish history, and we looked at his, in most instances, his or her life, and looked at it in context of the tragedies that he or she lived through. And so today I want to spend some time talking about one of the most colorful people in Jewish history, who, according to certain versions, has a yahrzeit coming up this week, although others say his yahrzeit is not in the month of Av. I want to talk about Don Isaac Abarbanel. We quoted him in the second minyan this morning when we were going through some of the kinos. We quoted from the Sefer Rosh Amana. We'll get a certain perspective. But I want you to get a sense of who the individual was, what his life is all about, and hopefully we'll get also a sense to understand what he went through in the course of his living. However, at the same point in time, consistent with the rules of the day, if you're not able to follow through on the sheets, don't worry, I'm going to stick very closely to non-overt Torah, things that are more Musar HaChayim, things we can learn from the individual's life. And I think hopefully that will give us a perspective. So Don Isaac Abarbanel. Don Isaac Abarbanel is born in Jewish history in Lisbon in 1437. He gets born into a very, very wonderful, powerful, wealthy family. His father was not only a wealthy individual, his father was a politically connected individual. His father, who was also known as Don, not because his first name was Donald, nor is that a political statement about where he sat in today's American politics. To be a Don, even back then, meant something. Cue the appropriate music. Da 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 da. Right? So he was the financier. He was a very wealthy individual, as his father, Don Yehuda, was a financier. And he was the financier of Prince Fernando, who was the son of the King of Portugal. And Abarbanel is born in Seville, and that's where his family was. Seville at the time was a very comfortable Jewish community. Why was it a comfortable Jewish community? It was a commercial center, and Jews had a lot of success in the commerce department. And so as a result, they enjoyed a certain degree of religious freedom and religious comfort, and certainly a lot of economic comfort. And it's this environment that Seville is, that the Abarbanel is born. Now, Abarbanel was also born into a different kind of Seville. In 1391, Seville was home to a number of Jewish massacres. And you have to remember that in 1481, Seville is going to be the place where the Spanish, the European Inquisition would open its first doors. Of course, what is the Inquisition all about? The Inquisition was the opportunity to do what? Well, to convert Jews? Is that the primary goal? Go ahead. Right. So I worked around for many, many years with the understanding that Marvin had, and Charlie obviously had a better Jewish history teacher than I did, because Charlie's correct. The real issue of the Spanish Inquisition was to discover the fakers. The people who had officially been converted, but whose conversion was, how shall we say, not as firm as the church wanted. And so therefore, that's really where things started. And that's where the primary focus of the church was. This is going to be significant for us to understand, because it's going to affect different aspects of our understanding of the Abarbanel, and also our understanding of Jewish history as a whole at that period in time.
But if he was an advisor to a prince of Portugal, what was he doing in Seville, Spain?
We'll discover. Okay? Jewish leaders in Seville discover that they have to be able to combat religious dogma, and the Abarbanel does so. However, as not as well known, the Abarbanel has a grandfather, Don Samuel, who did actually convert to Christianity publicly, and he uses this as an excuse to run away from Portugal. He was a high level converso, so that was part of the things that, you know, was a kind of a shock and didn't exactly make the Christian world so happy. Now you have to remember, in 1385, the thoughts in Portugal, where Portugal was. Portugal, just from a general perspective, in 1385, the Portuguese had fought the battle of, I'm going to pronounce this wrong, but it's Alabarota, and they had defeated Castile. And so they were now, here they were struggling, but they were looking for an identity, and when a country all of a sudden is in its early stages, so everyone is allowed to discover identity. We're still getting strong, and so Portugal was that way. And the Castilian Portuguese were very, very influenced by Islam. So anything that wasn't Islam in Portugal at that point in time was deemed to be very positive. And so the Portuguese in the late 1300s were very excited to welcome the Jewish colonizers and the Jewish traders, because, you know, good commerce and non-Islam was a good recipe. And by the way, it wasn't just Jewish. They were pretty much open to anybody who had national tendencies. Kind of interesting. When you start thinking about the world, when we get scared of one particular background, so then all of a sudden anybody who's not that background who will foster nationalistic ideas is welcome from the secular perspective. In 1391, succumbing to the overarching authority at the time in Europe, the overarching authority in the 1300s in Europe was?
The church.
And so therefore, even this young country had certain rules. And so one of the rules was the responsibility of all Jews to wear a badge. Sound familiar? Modern times, right? In 1391. And the rule was also, in 1404, was enacted by the church that all Jews can't serve in royal service. Sound familiar? Talk to the Germans. I'll be glad to tell you about it in the 1930s. However, there was a difference. When the laws went into effect in Germany, they were kept. Here, they were just laws that were on the books. They were not kept. And, of course, the Abarbanel family were the immediate beneficiaries of such a practice. The king of Portugal at the time was a king whose name was Alfonso. He was a strong defender of the Jews. And the structure he was on top of involved the nobility, but also the common people. And the common class was a group that was referred to as the burghers. And no, that's not a reference to the fact that I am still fasting and have been meat-deprived or burger-deprived appropriately. These were the different burghers. And they felt oppressed to a certain degree, so an opportunity to oppress the Jew, who often held a much stronger financial position, was something that had to be kept in check. And of course, King Alfonso finds himself in the situation where, yeah, everything is okay in terms of his life. So when the Abarbanel begins the book of Yehoshua, he introduces us exactly to where and what this whole picture was to him. As he says, Shalvaisi Bebesi Bais Vahon, he said, it was pretty comfortable. I had a nice house. There was wealth. Nachlas Avos Bais Mali Birkas Hashem Belizbona. I found myself filled with a comfortable home, filled with the bracha of Hashem in Lisbon, Mahulala Ir. Vimimalchus Portugal, and there it was. Lisbon was underneath the control of the Portuguese. Shamtziva Hashem Esabracha Basamai. There I was given the opportunity to live a life of wealth. One of the things we're going to discover when we discover the Abarbanel is he uses a very flowery language, very often wordy, but there's depth into his wording. He says, I built homes, basi beis vad lechachamim. You should just know, my home was a home where there were a lot of scholars. She just know there was great scholarship. Books came out of my home. Umosho mimosho memshal rav yared liyam ad yam He was able to fight. He says, I was living under the reign of King Alfonso, and he says he was a successful man. He fought ocean battles, and he fought other battles. It was all good. He said he was a king who did a lot of good things. Melech Poteach Bahashem. He believed in God. This is the Abar Menel talking about Alfonso, right? Vesar Meirai stayed away from bad. Vidorish Tov Liyamo, when he sought out good. Melech Besase Frasheyam Chacham Umikamo Umore. He was all great. He says, Acham Eitz Hadas, Chen V'Seichel Tov V'lo Ava Hashem Gamal Eitz Achaim Yishlach Yado. He tried to figure out whatever he could, and he was careful to give Revach V'Hatzala Amad Liyehudim, to give him a good sense of life. And as he closes out the first section, he says, V'chol Hayamim Asher Uchai Alo Adama Ahicham Achusa Dibava Mahalech Abias. He says it was all positive in such a situation. And indeed, history corroborates the Abar Menel's introduction to Sefer Yehoshua. History corroborates the fact that King Alfonso was quite successful in his conquest. Go ahead.
This was published while he was still in Portugal?
I will get there. We'll find out where Abar Menel's commentary on Yehoshua was published. We'll get there through his history. It's going to teach us something very fascinating, but excellent question. The answer is no. Right? So King Alfonso was successful. He goes to North Africa in 1471, he captures Arzila, and he picks up the Jews of Arzila over there as captives. And he turns to Don Isaac Abar Menel and he says to him, hey, you wanna ransom the Jews? And Abar Menel, for 10,000 doubloons, goes ahead and saves a whole group of Jews who can't even speak the language that the Abar Menel speaks, and they don't really have the means to connect with one another, but the only thing about them is they are Achenu B'nai Yisrael. And Abar Menel, together with the other wealthy members of Portugal, went ahead and made sure to ransom the Jews. And the Jews were also responsible for financing a lot of the other conquests of Portugal. And and that included the war with Castile in 1479. And in particular, the Abar Menel finds himself very, very close to one of the ruling families, not only the king, but also a family called the Bragzana family, which is a family that's very connected and winds up involved in the king's court. And all this was great, and life was good, until August 18th, 1481. Because on August 18th, 1481, if you're too intertwined with a particular king, you can run into a tremendous problem. What's the problem? Kings die. And on August 18th, 1481, Alfonso dies. And you know what the big problem is? That when a king dies at 49 years old, the next question is, who takes his place? And, you know, if you're 49 years old when you die, so it's quite possible that the next king, especially if it's a child, is likely to be younger than you. And that was indeed the case with the Abar Menel, right? When Alfonso died, the next king was King Ho. We'll see how we pronounce it, but it's Ho the Second, right? And King Ho the Second was 29. He takes over. So in his commentary to Shmuel Bet, the Abar Menel describes exactly what happens when Ho takes over. And I don't think I gave you that commentary in front of you, but let me read. Zeo Masha Ra'isi Lechtov, I don't think it's in front of you. Zeo Masha Ra'isi Lechtov, B'Ferosh HaSefer. This is what I want to write at the beginning of the Sefer. V'Aisach Haschaloso B'Yom Harishon L'Chodesh Teves. He says, I want you to know I started it on the beginning of the month of Teves. No, this is out of place, because we'll see where he puts it into place. He mentions exactly where it is, when he finally put out the Sefer on Shmuel, he says, but all this happened when he refers to King Ho'o, he refers to him, he says, as an Ish Mirma V'Avla Tefalteni, a man of deceit and a man of wickedness. And indeed, the king, Ho, you know, it's all about not only the king, but who he winds up coming in with. And certainly that was the case with King Ho. You know, whoever was giving him advice, it made a difference. So the king discovers that, you know, he gets a little nervous about the people around him. And remember, the Abarmanel is very connected with one of the very strong families, maybe call them more the princely, the court families, the Bregzana family. Well, the king doesn't get along very well with the Bregzanas, and he tries to manipulate them. And it leads to a certain problem. And the Abarmanel says in source number 2, Vayhi hayom yom tzara v'tochecha v'niyatza l'cholam olu Yisrael nachlaso b'nei Yaakov b'chirav. Well, that day that King Alfonso died, it becomes a great problem for the Jewish people. Hu hayom hayachoshech v'nafal l'mishkav. It was a dark day. U'ba'asher shachav nafal shadud. Kor v'chom yom v'layla lo yisbosu. He says it was a dark day. U'bayam ha'machadim alam avas b'chalonav kapta b'armono. He says, you know what happens after that. All of a sudden, fear grips the palace. Using various references to Psukim, you kind of see where the Abarbanel is going, and it ain't in a good place. Right? That's where the strength comes to Eloho. Kamotz Yisur Megoren Ukashan Me'aruba. He becomes like a dark cloud, and he says, and we quoted the pasuk Venosra Basion Kisukabakarim, and the Jewish people, right, were left like an open exposed element. Ve'ein Mashenu Mishena. There's nobody there to take care of them, and sure enough, he makes their life difficult. It becomes really bad, and as you can see, the Abarbanel reflecting on the period in time of King. Of the king Yoan, right? That's how he refers to Yo, right? He says he is a very difficult time, and as he says, Hafach libo lisno sarav lisnakel ba'avadav. He becomes very suspicious of the people around him. He thinks that something has to be cleaned out of his father's cabinet, and certainly Hakrovim Alav Etzmei Atzamav Basim Yibsarav. There were people who were so close to him that they were almost like family. Instead, what does he do? He issues an edict that they're identified and marked for death. Because he was worried that. They were all lining up to do what? To give him over to the Spanish. Spain and Portugal, not exactly comfortable neighbors. And so, Vayit post mayim sargoto mishna lamelech. He says, you know, they took the Bregzana family, the head of the Bregzana family, Vayamas Sobacharev. And what did they do? They killed him. Be'echav anisharim heranasu baruchu l'nafsham. The rest of the family knew if you kill one, so you better run, because you're, you know, now the rest of you are marked. When he saw the head of the Bargzana family was dead, they realized there was a problem over here, and so they disappeared. And the king, of course, does what when he has a political enemy? He takes all their wealth. So of course they go from being this very comfortable wealthy family to being nothing. And who gets the wealth? King Yoho. By the way, lest you think this is all good and wonderful, what does this have to do with the Abarbanel? If you're advising the family, you know what happens? You're linked with the family. And of course, if you're wealthy and linked with the family, so the king turns to you and says, hey, wait a second, real or not, even if I can prove that you're innocent, right? It doesn't matter, because at the very least, what can I do? I can exact a very serious financial gain out of you. And certainly that is what happens to the Abarbanel. As he describes in source number 3, he says, God, the king was pretty, he was after me as well. And he says, after the early days, right, I had a very good relationship. And I was pretty close. But then all of a sudden, you know, they said, look, you're going to be in that situation. And, you know, they're going to try to kill you. And the king actually sent a mishlachas malchei royim. He sent a group of soldiers to go in and take the Abarbanel in. He wasn't bringing him in for innocent questioning, donuts and coffee. You know, when you got brought in, you often didn't go out. It was like the Roach Motel. You checked in, but you didn't check out. And what is the Abarbanel here? He hears Amelech Diber, the king spoke, Redai Lai Al Tamot, source number three in the middle. He says, come down to me. And of course, Rabbi Menel starts traveling, but when he gets to the place, and he's on his trip, and he, all of a sudden he hears a message, Vayi Adarech Bamalon, he stopped the camp one night, and a bunch of the Barzana family members, or those who were close to the family members, said to him, listen, you're in trouble, don't come here, run away, because look, our family members have been wiped out. And so the Abarbanel has no choice. Here he is traveling by himself, and he hears the situation, so he turns and runs. And so he runs away. He has to leave behind his family, and he realizes that that's not the greatest situation in the world, but he and his wife and three of his children escape with their lives. And so here he is. He's a political enemy. He's got the whole world interested in coming after him. He's got his whole Portuguese government that, for whom he is identified as a enemy of the state. He's successful in crossing the border. We'll see where he crossed and what he was trying to do in a second. But one thing we'll say is that for the first couple of years, he managed to keep the channel open to Yoho, but eventually he is framed with a title of being a Ben Mavas, of being an individual who is considered, as far as the crown is concerned, liable for the death penalty. Running away doesn't exactly help you when you kind of don't look innocent when that's the case. And the Abarbanel notes in his introduction to the Book of Devarim, the Abarbanel actually notes and states, this is not one of those classes, the Abarbanel notes and actually states in his introduction that he feels when he was running away and actually went to Castile, right? He says, even his own neighbors, ki achai ve'ami v'chol shcheinai svivosai tzarai, even some of the Jews had turned on the Abarbanel. They were going to turn the Abarbanel in. And during the, you know, it's at this point in time that he finds himself in Castile, and at this point in time that the Abarbanel realizes he has to do something with his life. So what do you mean he has to do something with his life? It looks like he had lived a pretty busy political life at this point in time. What do you mean to do? So in the next 4.5 months, the Abarbanel sits down and starts to teach Torah. Not only does he teach, but he writes. And apparently the people liked his classes very much because he continued to write. And in 4.5 months, the Abarbanel goes ahead and completes a commentary to Yoshua, to Shoftim, to Shmuel, and to Malachim. That's a tremendous, well, most of Malachim, right? That's a tremendous feat by any standard, right? When you look at the Abarbanel's style of teaching and the style of his commentary, it's nothing short of amazing. Because the Abarbanel, as we pointed out before, as a commentary, as an individual, is not somebody who, you know, makes a comment here, a comment there on a verse here or there in the Psukim. He writes huge essays. His style is to begin with a series of questions, right? Sometimes as many as 20, 25 questions, and then to reinterpret, you know, accordingly. And so this ability becomes something that he feels, that now he's doing something with his life.
But this might have not happened if he'd stayed in Portugal and if the new king had been a good king.
And we'll talk about that, and that does have a certain understanding, and we are, you know, it does raise certain questions for us. If he would have stayed in Portugal with a certain king, maybe he would have lost, and maybe that's one of the tensions that sometimes Jews feel, right, in our lives. Are we supposed to live our lives completely spiritually Torah-based, or is there room for somebody to be involved in the political? Certainly, that is a question that comes up historically, even in modern times. Rav Yosef Kahneman was known as the Panovitcher Rav. He's an example that comes to mind, Rav Moshe Scherer being the other one off the top of my head without batting an eyelash. Rav Kahneman, the Panovitcher Rav, spent his entire life rebuilding Panovich after the war, which meant kind of sort of de facto rebuilding Bnei Brak. And he was the official head of the yeshiva in Panovich. And Rabbi Teitz will tell you very straight from his own experiences, there was no question about it. However, it was also evident that he was not the one who was able to sit down and write and compose tomes of Torah Navalei. It was those he brought in to teach in his yeshiva who had that ability. And every year, and the Panovitcher Rav was incredible when it came to spreading Torah. It was incredible. He introduced programs all over Israel that have impact until today. And he always graced them with his Torah brilliance. And his and he took such pride. But there were times where he would turn to his students and turn to his beloved co-Rosh Yeshiva and to actually comment and note that, yeah, there are times in my life that, I didn't get a chance to write these Sfarim. I didn't get a chance to do that type of learning. But those that look around, he would point to the students in Panovich. And he would say, this is my learning. I dare say, look at all the other yeshivos. And by the way, if you've listened to Rabbi Teitz talk about what Panovich was like when he was there, which means the way it was said, meant to be, that means all the children of Panovich yeshivos, which, by the way, look a lot different than you would imagine in your own mind today when you think Panovich. So Rabbi Teitz has talked about in this very building, he says in his day, 25% by rule of the Panovich Rav, 25% of all acceptances into Panovich had to come from non-Haredi schools. Kids who had gone to high school. This is Rabbi Teitz's report. He was in the place. And as Rabbi Teitz is off to say, we're pretty lucky that was the rule, because otherwise there would be no Rav Avigdor and Abensal, among others. The great Rav of the old city of Yerushalayim, who was a graduate of Panovich, but went to a yeshiva high school, Dati Lumi school in Israel. You have to understand, and you have to figure out, sometimes there is a cost for trying something. Rabbi Moshe Scherer was the political head of Aguda, the head of Agudas Yisrael of America. We're talking about an individual who had a tremendous impact on American Jewry, a tremendous, wide-ranging impact, right? But still, it came at a cost for him. Notwithstanding, I don't think that, I think we need to appreciate where the person came from. And Abarbanel deals with this tension throughout his life, because he's not really doing a tremendous amount of writing when he gets involved politically. And here he finds himself in Castile in 4.5 months, is able to put out huge, huge amounts of commentary. Nothing you wanted to add? I want to just publicly state something. I'll get to you in a sec. But I thank Nathan Hyman. He helped me a lot with the research for this year, so I thank him in advance. Did you want to add something? Okay, go ahead, Dr. Friedman.
This family that was, this powerful family,
mm-hmm.
that went on to the Alps, how were they related to the previous king?
I don't remember the exact connection, distant, but also close to the court. They definitely had political appointment, and they were very involved in the finances, but to be fair and honest,
they weren't family.
They were certainly not very, very, if they were intertwined, it wasn't very close.
Okay.
So be it.
So they weren't the...
Correct.
From the same party, they weren't family.
Yeah, well, certainly not enough that he felt that that this was a familial challenge. Correct. Okay. So in 14... So Abarbanel finds himself in this situation. He's living in Castile, which is right over the border, right? And he's obviously able to converse to a certain degree with his family in Portugal, right? The messages are coming across, because at some point his wife and some of his kids are able to join him. And also, he's able to plead some of his case, which is going to be important to him towards the end of his life, which hopefully we'll get to, right? But still, at the same time, he's on the border. And if you're on the border, where are you not? In the capital. Well, as luck has it, in 1484, Abarbanel gets invited to go meet with the king and queen of Spain. And here's where a lot of our understanding of history comes to play. So the Abarbanel writes in his introduction to Malachim, he says, "Vimalta rakani boreach amalchus Castilla." He says, "I found myself writing. I was the only one of the family who ran away mipnei cherev hayona to Castile. Ubevoi shama biosi kiger ba'aretz koreach nitalolun darashte me'al sefer Hashem l'shalem es neshai upirashti shloshes asvar marishonim." He says he made it his business to publish the first three books, Yoshua. Why does he write his commentary on Yoshua? Yoshani Elokim be'atzilenu mi'cher of Paro. I felt that God saved me. Yoshua comes from the word salvation. And so his first commentary, that's where he begins. Bishoftim, right? Ki yesh Elokim shoftim ba'aretz l'shpot mishpati v'lariv rivi me'ish chamosim. So he says the book of Shoftim because he recognized that there was a justice God was definitely aware of. Ushmuel ki me'ashem shaltiv. And at Vayaze Betchila Shnas Reish Mandalad Me'alaf Hashishi Li'Yitzira Ubertosi L'Haskel B'Pir Sefer Malachim. As I was beginning to write down my commentary on the Book of Malachim, what happens? The Book of Kings, right? Nekresi Lavo Abeis HaMelech U'Melech Sfarad Elyon L'Malchei Yaretz. I get called in to go ahead and meet with the king, King Ferdinand. Now remember, what year did I tell you this was? 1484. Why is that year important? Well, why is that time frame important? What year are we targeting in the back of our heads? 1492. Now look at the difference in the years. What are you talking about? A grand total of 8 years. And what's going to happen in 1492, folks? The expulsion from Spain. 8 years before the expulsion from Spain, King Ferdinand, who is going to be the royal monarch, who's going to kick the Jews out of Spain, reaches out to a refugee Jew who's living on the border, who's basically walking around as a walking dead man if he ever steps foot in Portugal again. This is the version of the Abarbanel. And so he says, he gets called over there. It's always important for me to note that historical time frame, because it's incredible to think how clear 8 years can be. Someone can be, and in our country, in the country we currently find ourselves in, right? This country, which is a Malchus Shel Chesed. But 8 years can flip things upside down real fast. Real, real fast. So interesting to see. In the 1400s, that was the case as well. And so what happens? He says, he goes to the king. Ubasi al Chatzar Beis HaMelech Vashagel. I go with the king, and he does not have a very strong opinion about Queen Isabella, right? And Hayisi Karov Elehem Yamim Rabim. And he says, I became very close to Ferdinand. And by the way, he becomes even more close to Isabella, right? Not in any other way other than she had much greater financial needs. And he had amassed, once again, a certain degree of financial means. He says, I became close to them. I worked for them for 8 years, which means... Well, you're dealing with the different countries. You're dealing with... The Spanish can't remove a death penalty from the Portuguese, right? What he did was he successfully avoided it. However, you're asking an interesting question, because we're going to see what happens towards the end of the Abarbanel's life, where he has to go ahead and make a play and try to make some sort of peace between these different countries economically. Says, unfortunately, I had to put my Torah work on the side, which is a terrible, horrible experience, because clearly Abarbanel was singing the song of Torah, and it worked for him. It's because of the needs to take care of world history, that is to say, he realized he was involved in world politics of the day, I had to put my primary life, the life of Jewish history, on the side, and writing up Jewish destiny. Now, let's talk a little bit about the climate, or what we'll call the Abarbanel's work environment. So here he is, he's working for Ferdinand and Isabella. And anyone know anything about King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella? So Queen Isabella, we know, she took her jewels and she used them to finance Columbus's voyage. Columbus, of course, set out in what year to sail the ocean blue? 1492. That's the ditty we learned in school, right? In 1492, Columbus sailed the blue. He captured the British. He made them say the Kiddush, right? That's the way we were told it. Sheev education, all different. Well, as I told you, just like we had burghers living in Portugal, right? And it's a class of society. So you have burghers in Spain as well, right? And so the burghers of Spain, they get a little bit excited, and of course, who are they interested in getting excited at? The class above them, who happen to be different because they serve a different god, right? And so the burgher party, or the burgher level of society, is really getting stronger. Advancement in the Kingdom of Spain requires an individual to hit the top levels of Spanish society. What do you have to practice? Yes, Christianity. Very good. And so, very often, Jews in Spain, unfortunately, became, at least publicly, baptized and set aside and conversos. Well, if I'm a burgher and I'm born into it, and he converts and he's able to grow into it, you start to raise your eyebrows and you start to wriggle your nose a little bit. And this indeed was a situation that was going on in Spain. And the burghers were particularly very anti-converso, right? Or what we would call anti-Morano. And the Jews also were not so excited. A Jew sees another guy, like, you know, one day your friend Jaime Goldstein is, you know, next door to you, right? And the next day he's known as Christopher von Christie, and he's wearing very fancy Christian robes, right? And now all of a sudden you're like, hey, you know, what happened to my buddy Jaime? Right? And you know, Jaime says, no problem. Come Shabbos afternoon down to the basement. We'll have Kiddush together. Right? Someone was telling me Friday night, I don't remember who it was, but they were walking with somebody on Friday night, and he was telling me about his trip to Spain and how he met, you know, this individual who for years could not understand why in his family there was a tradition. And he's totally Christian. He says, totally Christian. But he lives very differently than everybody else, because on Friday evening they light candles in the home and they insist on having a meal. Right? And they have a meal every Friday night with candles. Right? And I wonder out loud, I have to wonder out loud, do you know what kind of background he comes from? Mrs. Sauerhoff showed me pictures on one of her trips when she was telling me the stories also of a huge Catholic city where everybody has minhagim, which I must tell you sound very similar to Jewish practice. I don't think that all these people can marry into our faith because they're that far removed from our faith, right? I don't think they've intermarried enough to guarantee the Judaism, but it's interesting to see what stayed in different people's mindset. Well, the burghers are not particularly happy about this. And, you know, Ferdinand is officially keeping everybody happy so that his rule stays strong, but Ferdinand is a very slippery character. And everyone who thinks they understand what his next step is, it's not. And he's very good at keeping people on his toes, on their toes and his toes. And ultimately, what became important for him was what? Financing the crown. And whoever was able to finance the crown, so be it. Well, the church always had hatameya hatadeh, as they say, and the church had the ultimate ability. And so Ferdinand allows the he allows the Inquisition to work its way into Spain in order to officially do what he calls purify the Spanish crown. But this is, you know, again, most of this purification process is not against the practice of Judaism. The Jews were low, right? This is really more purifying the Christian Catholic Church and the Christian Spanish Church in particular. So it was really about getting rid of whom? The conversos, very good. So Ferdinand recognizes this, and he allows the Inquisition to sort of set itself up, but he waits a few years until things get really, really revved up. And during that time, Ferdinand is involved in a war with Grenada. When Reagan fought Grenada, everyone made fun of Reagan. But when Ferdinand fought Grenada, right, it was a very big deal. And so he finishes his war. And as the years go on, 1484, 1486, in 1486, there's an edict that's issued that Jews have to remove themselves from Andalusia and Aragon, and the Jews don't really think too much about it. So we're not living in that place, we're living in another place. And they don't see what's going on. Abarbanel himself, in his introduction to his commentary on the Haggadah Shel Pesach, also notes that he failed to see what was going on. And he continues to rise in his own personal position in the Spanish court. And he lends huge sums of money to Queen Isabella. He's fixing up the economic situation for the Spanish king. And he's pretty happy about the life that he's living in the late 1480s. And he's totally unaware of what we, looking back, are about to see coming. Go ahead.
I thought that in part that during the Inquisition, one of their goals was was essentially, I'm not going to use the word convert, but to convince the Jews to give up their religion and become Catholic, and then they didn't get persecuted.
We're going to get there. Very good, yes. But there, the assumption in the conversion process was not this fake conversion that Charlie was pointing out before. The Burghers didn't have a problem with somebody who converted for real. Their problem was that they smelled that a lot of this was tainted, right? It was fake. And certainly that was the goal initially of the Spanish Inquisition, to purify. This and this is the way things find themselves into the early 1490s. Well, on January 2nd, 1492, Grenada falls. And the assumption was this is a great time, the Jews are going to be at peace, and then out of the blue, King Ferdinand issues an expulsion order. And the Jews are beside themselves. They didn't know what hit them. Shavas misos libenu, as we said. They didn't see the handwriting on the wall, and they didn't see what was happening, and all of a sudden they see this expulsion order. So what's the first thing you do? Make plans to nefesh benefesh, halavai, but that's not what happened. What did the Jews first try to do? Get it rescinded. And so what do? You look for who's close to the king, right? And you try to pay him off. Who's close to the king at this period in time? Well, we know one person, the Abarbanel. So the Abarbanel describes how he met with King Ferdinand. He pleaded with King Ferdinand. In certain places and ways, he gets King Ferdinand to agree to rescind the order for a very large amount of money. Which, remember, having just finished a battle with Grenada, right, King Ferdinand was all too happy to accept. And Abarbanel walks away thinking everything's going to be okay. But as I pointed out to you, Ferdinand is a slippery individual, right? And some might say that, Aseres Alafim Kikar Kesef, of a different period in Jewish history, of a different king, who is often taught to the children to be a silly king, a dilly king, right? The title could be applied to King Ferdinand. The only thing silly and dilly is the fact that they are both kings, Achashverosh and Ferdinand, were slippery characters. And Ferdinand turns around and says, "It's not my fault. I can't get rid of the expulsion order. I'm married. It's her fault. It's her fault." He blames Queen Isabella, and he says that you have to convince Isabella. She's the frum one. I'm just a practical economic king. I'm not so frum. Right? I don't really care that much about, purifying the Spanish crown, but she's the firm one. Now, Abarbanel thinks he's got himself in a great position. Why? Because not only does he have a hold over Isabella, he has a relationship with Isabella because he's been financing things with Isabella. And so he turns to Isabella and he starts debating her about why this is a bad plan. And he tells her, at one point he turns to her and he says to her, "Don't you know what happens to people who kick the Jews out? Don't you understand what happens to this nation?" And he starts quoting her from Scripture. She is, after all, the religious one in the pair. And so he tells her, look, he gets to the point of telling her that you're gonna be wiped out, And Isabella, who is, of course, quite versed in Scripture herself, turns and says, look, you're Hashem. If you're so right, Mr. Abarbanel, Don, right? If you're so right, so tell me something, why are you in Spain? Right? Your God, the same God that you're quoting to me, your God, he clearly is not in agreement with you, which is certainly something that, as we find in the Talmud and other places, was a claim made constantly. That, right? Where's your God? The idea of being Nivchar, of being a God's chosen people, is something that nations of the world didn't exactly appreciate and understand. And in all this, it really wasn't Isabella. She's the one who's involved in the debates, but it's not Isabella who needed to be convinced, because that's Ferdinand's style. He blames everyone else. And so by the time the official expulsion order is officially handed out, the Jews have 3 months to be out. And some Jews go to Portugal, some go to North Africa. The Abarbanel and his family turn around, and they go to Italy. Before the Abarbanel is kicked out of Spain, He gets a reprieve. What does that mean? Ferdinand and Isabella appreciated Abarbanel. Why? He was economically very important to the crown. He was a great financial advisor. And they said to him, look, if you convert, it'll all be good. By the way, you should just know, Abarbanel was one half of the dynamic duo of Jewish advisors to the king. There was another individual whose name was Avraham Senor. And when the same option was presented to Senor, he converted. In fact, it was so serious that when Abraham Senor converted, he converted in the church of Santa Maria de Guadalupe, which is, by the way, one of those sites you can go visit today. And the sponsors of his conversion were none other than Ferdinand and Isabella, and Cardinal Mendoza was really the third wheel of control over Spain in those days. And they tried very hard to try to convince the Abarbanel, go ahead, you know, Senor, went ahead and converted. So, you know, it'll be good for you, and we'll take care of you. They even tried to steal and kidnap the Abarbanel's one-year-old grandson, and they were going to baptize the grandson, because, of course, once he was a Christian, you can't leave him in Jewish hands. And luckily, the word got to the Abarbanel, he spirited his grandson out of the country before they were able to get him.
What about his... He lends all this money to the king. How is he ever going to get it back?
Let me explain it to you this way. In 1492, when the Jews left, do you think that they walked out with gold and silver and all sorts of good things? That happens only when God goes ahead and says, right, when the Jews left Mitzrayim, God makes sure. The answer is that one of the great things about kicking Jews out of a place is that you kick the Jews out, but you don't get their property goes to the crown. And this, by the way, was one of the big underlying positive developments as far as the Spanish was concerned of the expulsion. Not only do you kick the Jews out, but you get all their wealth short term. So Dr. Wenger points out, and he says, look, you know, this argument is only true short term because you lose all the wisdom, you lose all the benefit. You should just know that argument was made in advance to King Ferdinand, and he kind of felt otherwise just for the sake of the immediate need. And so sure enough, the Abarbanel writes about this in his introduction to the Book of Malachim. He says, in the ninth year, Lachad Melech Sfarad Komachus Grenada, Ve'era Gedola, and he said, and then he says, he refers to him, he says, Vayomer Isa Belibo, Vamois Ratzel Elokaya, Mazreni Chayel Amilchama. He compares King Ferdinand to? Yeah, not exactly what, you know, a positive identification. And he tries to figure out what is he going to do, how is he going to achieve, and so he goes ahead and the Abarbanel writes out in story form that which we just spoke out. I want to call your attention to one comment, though, because, you know, we talk a lot about the Spanish Inquisition. Let's read the Abarbanel's understanding of the Spanish Inquisition. The Spanish expulsion, right? 1492. Yirmiyahu Perek Beis, source number 8 in front of you, he says, Bachadasha yimtza'ua alo tira sheba'oso achodesh. Which month is he talking about? Yeah, well, he's talking about the month of Av. Nigzer gzera al dora midbar, shesham yamusu. Right? On that month, there was a gzeira on the Jews that they would die in the Midbar. When was that? When was the month that the Jews were given the gzeira? We talked about this morning. Tisha B'Av, right? That's when the Jews got the message, because they cried the whole night. Right? V'leil tes B'Av, haya bo bayom nechrav bayis rishon, bo bayom nechrav bayis sheni, bo bayom nechrav Alexandria kal gadome yudim shaya shama. Right? He says, even Alexandria in Egypt, which is something I learned from the Abarbanel, I did not know that prior, right, about the destruction of Alexandria. But he says, that's when it was destroyed. Bo bayom na'asa garush ekseya aretz anikra Anglia, right? There was an English expulsion. Ubo bayom na'asa garush tzvas, that's when the French expulsion was. And Gareshi Gareshi Schemi Zed, that was the month where you're also going to be kicked out. V'kama od me ashmados agrushim hayu b'chodesh ahuli Yisrael. There were other also times that situations happened like that within the Jewish people. Ma'usuf od l'daber, he says, what am I going to add in? V'nikshe gazer melech sfarad garosh gerush al kol ha'yudim asher b'chom adinos ma'chuso she'yetsu kim l'shlosh chadashim nishlam v'haya yom ha'yitziyah tes ba'av. He says, guess what? When you start to take a look at the way things worked out, when were the Jews kicked out of Spain? The Abar ben El says it was on the 9th above. V'hu lo yadami zazman, right? He, Ferdinand, didn't know about this time. Davar ki lumen hashamayim hedrichu l'agbala zazman hazeh. It must have been God who directed him to pick this particular date. L'kayim dvar ha'navi she'amer b'chadasha yimtza'ua. To fulfill the words of the Navi. And so he says that's the way it was. That's the way God sets things up. It wasn't he, it was God himself. And so Abarbanel finds himself leaving. And so he goes to those who went to Portugal. And he tells us those who went to northern Africa, he says, those people suffered terribly. He says, this frankly, they got very sick on the seas. And he writes in the back in the book of Malachim how their situation was terribly difficult. He says he instead chose to go to Italy. And so he gets into Italy, and as he gets to Italy, his situation gives him a chance to get a brief respite in his life in Nepal. And that came about because the king of Nepal at the time, Ferrante, right, showed a little bit of chesed. So now the Abarbanel finds himself growing up with the chesed of King Alfonso in Portugal. For a little brief respite over there, he is able to ingratiate himself to King Ferdinand, right? And now here he is with Ferrante. But unfortunately, Nepal... Naples is about to be attacked by one of three sides. The Spanish are trying to work their way in, right? And so he finds himself, about to go back to the old situation where he can't live. He has to be expelled. The French are trying to get in. The French were more Catholic, more tied to the church than the Spanish. And those two situations are not good for the Jews. So Ferrante realizes his situation, and he realizes what's going on, and he decides that the only thing for him to do is to abdicate the throne. But at this point in time, he had this little advisor that was pretty close to him, whose name was Don Isaac Abarbanel. So when he abdicates the throne, he takes Abarbanel with him. And he settles for 7.5 years in Manapoli, right? And while he's there, he sits down for 7.5 years. Right? When you're living in a government in exile, what do? Not a tremendous amount. You're not rewriting economic systems. So what do? You learn.
Get back to
you go back and you write. And Abarbanel again sits for 7.5 years. And he's writing and he's writing. And not only does he complete some of his commentaries on Navi, except for Yeshayahu, which he goes back and finishes really, really close to the end of his life, but he starts writing on messianic themes. Tremendous amount of work and messianic themes. And also his commentary to Pirkei Avos. It all gets written during this period in time. And he believes that, he writes in around the year 1500, he believes that there's an apocalypse that's about to come to play between Christian forces and Islamic forces. And in the year 1500, he starts writing about this in his commentaries on the books of Ksuvim. And so this continues until Ferrante tries to take back his kingdom, and Abarbanel tries to work with him. At the end of his life, Abarbanel finds himself in Venice, and he sees that he's told to give himself an opportunity to broker some sort of deal. Now the Italians had a certain benefit for them. What was that? They controlled a lot of the trade routes to the spice routes. Right. However, once a lot of the discoveries that we learn about in 4th, 5th, and 6th grade in social studies about the New World. And once those discoveries are made, then all of a sudden the role of getting to the spice routes to the Far East do not become as important. And so the Italians lose their spice route. They want to try to broker certain treaties in order to preserve their kingdom. Abarbanel is brought in. Now here he is. He's a Ben Mavis in Portugal. He is a unwelcomed individual in France, in Spain. And he finds himself at the bargaining table on behalf of Italy with all the old groups. And everyone is willing to work with him because he's the bright one. And everyone knows that economically it's kedai, it's a worthwhile experience to work with him. However, he's unsuccessful in that process for various reasons. And he spends the last couple of years of his life turning to his writing instead. And this is really an introduction into the life of the Abarbanel, but also an introduction to the life of people living in Galus. And to me, there are so many different lessons to be discussed from studying the life of the Abarbanel. Some of them are the ones that we pointed out before. How a Jew in the exile is supposed to be able to reconcile his spiritual life, his responsibilities, the other with his physical life, to live day in and day out. I think primary in the Abarbanel's life is that he found himself trying to walk that tightrope between his spiritual life and his ability to live day in and day out. And I think so much in our world works the same way. Well, we're stuck also spending time trying to figure out how are we supposed to negotiate. Well, the Abarbanel laments the way he had to operate. And he looked forward for those opportunities where he was able to sit down and really engage in the spiritual pursuit of God. And lesson number one from his life is that. Lesson number two, he never gives up. I mean, it's incredible, no? He never gives up. And I think a Jew walking among the nations of the world has to, on the one hand, never give up, but on the other hand, has to do what the Abarbanel does point out constantly, and to realize that while you never give up, you never put all your eggs in the other basket. David HaMelech makes this clear, and I find it fascinating that we quote it every morning right before we go to work. Al tiftechu b'nedivim b'ven adam she'en lo tshuva. Never put your trust fully in the hands of do-gooders and human beings who have no salvation. Teitzei rucho yashuv lad maso. Which is, it's not only true for tires, it's true for human beings, right? That if you take out the air out of the tire, it lies flat. Yashuv lad maso. It's true for human beings as well. And certainly that was the case over the course of the Abarbanel's life. Sometimes we place so much stock, and in today's society, so clear, we place a tremendous amount of stock in different political people. We often give them titles that they're not worthy of. And I'm not making a political statement on any particular secular politician. There's a way to be makir tov. And I think there is no question that anybody who lacks hakaras hatov towards malchus, towards the country that hosts you, you know, is missing something very fundamental in their lives. The greats of our generation did not tell us to walk around not being grateful citizens. We have a responsibility to be grateful citizens. Abarbanel taught us that you should contribute and do your share while you're here. If you have a talent, utilize it. But at the same time, don't expect it to turn around and be there for you. That is the local governments are really just cover for the big guy upstairs. And no matter where we go, and no matter what we do, and no matter where we are, on a positive, and sometimes when we forget, it becomes something that God has to smack us in the face with to remind us that no matter what you think, in the end of the day, Hashem Elokei Yisrael Melech, the real king is HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Umachuso Bakol Mashallah. God rules over everything. If you think you're moving away from him like Yonah did, it ain't going to happen. Look at Abarbanel, he also had to travel by sea. Right? If you think that you're going to be able to try to work the situation out without recognizing God, that's impossible. And maybe that's one of the things that we need to take with ourselves as we walk through Galus. One of the comments that we've gone through together on our morning little pieces on Tzipis Eli Yeshua was the understanding that many of our great Jewish philosophers, have always pointed out that the job of a Jew in the Galus is to do what we call being Mekabetz Nitzotzos, to go gather and garner all the sparks of holiness that exists within the world. And that's what a Jew is supposed to do. Well, in order for something to have a nitzotz of Kedusha in the Galus, we have to realize that there has to be godliness associated with it. We take lives of the great ones who lived before us, and we use it the way they did. We'll find the Spirit of God, even in the things that we have to do, and we will make sure that all of our actions are l'shem shamayim, and those actions will lead us back to really where we want to go, to that state where Ushmo Echad. HaKadosh Baruch Hu make it so speedily in our day. Reb Chananya ben Akash Omer Atzah HaKadosh Baruch Hu Lizak says Yisrael Lefich HaChir Balam Torah Mitzvah Shneimah Adonai HaFetz Man Siko Yagdi El Torah Yadir.